The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Donald Trump continues to dominate so much the news. I think there's only two reactions really to that. One is to say, I am completely fed up of hearing about Donald Trump. Can we please talk about something else? And the other response is to say, well, what is going on here? This is a momentous event. I want to hear more. Well, whatever your view, we're going to try and keep you happy on today's Trumpet Daily Radio. I want to take a step back and look at the broader trend that Donald Trump is a part of. It's a trend that was clearly visible before Donald Trump took office, so we'll step back, we'll talk about some other news, some other elections within Europe, but we will come back to Mr. Trump towards the end. If you're listening online, you'll notice that I've called this program Pirates, Peasants, and Donald Trump. At least I will have called that if the editors don't change it. Editors can be killjoys at times. But hopefully they'll have kept that title. And today we're going to talk about the pirates and the peasants before we get to Donald Trump. Because, as I said, they are all part of that same trend. And this important trend that he is a part of is a rejection of liberal democracy. Across the world, different groups are opposing liberal democracy and putting forward their own alternatives. Now, before we really get started on this, we need to define our terms. You know, liberal is one of those... I don't know of any word perhaps more flexible in how it's used than liberal. It can be bent to mean almost anything. A liberal could refer to an almost anarchic libertarian who wants the government to do almost nothing. And it could also be used to describe a radical socialist who wants the government to control every aspect of an individual's life. So when we talk about liberal democracy on today's show, I mean that in modern times, a consensus in the Western world has emerged about what a democracy should look like and the way it should work. And so that's what I'm referring to. And really, Western-style democracy would probably be a better term, but liberal democracy is what a lot of commentators use when they talk about it, so I will stick with it. Now, what is this? What does this liberal democracy, this kind of consensus democracy that's emerged, look like? There are a very wide variety of democratic systems in the West, but they all tend to have the same features and the same kind of things when it in terms of the way they work. So they're all representative democracies. So the people don't actually decide policies themselves. Instead, they elect representatives of some kind who make those decisions for them. There's also a separate judiciary, and so the people who are elected, they don't interfere day-to-day in court proceedings. And then also the way that this, what's emerged, especially in recent times, is the judiciary can overrule the representatives of the people. And so we see this in much of Europe, we see this in America. Aspect of liberal democracy, and again this is one that's really emerged in the last 20 years or so, is an independent central bank. And the government has stepped back from a lot of the ways that the central bank runs the economy, and then it operates within certain quote-unquote liberal, again that's a word that can mean almost anything, liberal norms. So there are certain things that is considered beyond the pale for a government to do, and we'll talk more about some of those liberal norms later. But right now, all across the world, there are movements saying, this is not working. Liberal democracy is broken. The way that we've conducted democracies is broken. And in many ways, they're right. Liberal democracy has a great deal of problems, and we'll see them as we go through. But at the same time, and this is why this is such an important subject, this is a dangerous trend. People are saying now, you know, it's not just the people currently in office that we don't like. It is our whole political system. It's not a case of kicking out this party or that party. We need to change fundamentally the way our country is run. And as I said, the way the country is run in a lot of ways isn't working properly. But this alternative can lead to great instability and can, as we said, be very dangerous. And one way we can see that it's dangerous is looking back to the 1930s. Because we saw the same trend then. So during the late 19th century and the early 20th century, there was a growing consensus that democracy was the way to go. Monarchies became constitutional monarchies. Parliaments, people's assemblies gained more power. You had countries in Latin America that were gaining their independence. And usually the kind of the default way they would set themselves up post-independence was, instead of with their own monarchy, as had been the case in the past, it was setting themselves up as a democracy. Now, how stable and long-lasted those democracies were is a separate subject, but democracy was generally considered the way to go if you were setting up a new country. And then even in autocratic countries like Russia, there was a lot of pressure to adopt liberal reforms. So in 1861, Russia freed the serfs. In the early 20th century, you had Pyotr Stolypin introducing his reforms to Russia that granted a lot more freedom to the general populace. And then you had World War I, which ended in this bonfire of empires, and some of the biggest dynasties in European history were destroyed. The Romanovs in Russia went down in the Communist Revolution. It ended the Habsburgs ruling Austria. The Ottomans in Turkey, the Ottoman Empire collapsed. The Hohenzollerns, Kaiser Wilhelm and his family was then deposed in Germany. And in their place, you saw new democracies arose. You saw new independent states that were democratic. And so democracy seemed the answer, that it led to freedom and prosperity. And then you had the late 1920s. You had this massive economic crisis. Russia, after the war, had built itself into a strong communist state under Stalin, and communists were threatening other revolutions in other countries. Mussolini had by this point come to power as a strong man in Italy. And then within a few years of economic collapse, you had Adolf Hitler and the Nazis come to power in Germany. And at this point, people's confidence in democracies being the future wavered greatly. Small states, they weren't now becoming democracies, they were turning towards fascism or communism. Authoritarianism seemed the way to go, and people in the West began talking about how democracy wasn't working, that strongmen like Hitler, like Mussolini, were the way to go, and that became common. Just to give one example of this, in the West, you had a Nobel Prize winner, Anatole France, who was a French Nobel Prize winner. He wrote during this rough time period that the Republic was a woman lacking the male principle of initiative and action. The only way to improve democracy, destroy it. Democracy is evil. Democracy is death. Death. Democracy is forgetting. And he said that the people who are governed by men of action and military leaders defeat those people who are governed by their lawyers and professors. And that was some common sentiment. That democracies were always going to be weaker than authoritarian regimes and hence inferior. And so this degrading of democracy, it led to this widespread, well, you saw how the economic instability from the late 1920s, the 1930s, that economic crash, it led to the delegitimization of democracy. People rejected democracy as there was no longer this idea that it was the default form of government. People searched for other ideas, and it ultimately led to instability and authoritarianism. And now we see something similar. We see this consensus emerging that liberal democracy has failed. So where could this lead? Well, it's leading to people experimenting with alternatives. And we see this already. You know, some of these alternatives, maybe they would be better than liberal democracy, others are worse. But then if and when these alternatives fail to solve these problems, well, what then? And so this whole way of governing that has governed the West for the last 70 years is now being questioned. And that has to be of great concern to all of us. So before we get into where this can and could lead, let's look at some specific examples of how democracy is being questioned and the alternatives being put forward. Now, one of the first that we'll look at that's being put forward now as an alternative, as a new system, a new way of doing things that's not liberal democracy, is direct democracy. Now, this differs mainly from liberal democracy in that it is not a representative democracy. Instead of the people choosing representatives who make decisions on their behalf, the people themselves make those decisions. And this is becoming an increasingly popular idea, and it is quite a radical idea. If you go back and look at what some of the Founding Fathers wrote and things like the Federalist Papers, there was a lot of talk of avoiding this kind of direct democracy. They felt that it would lead to a lot of instability, and a lot of that was based on the example of ancient Greece, where direct democracy led to the nation, you know, sentencing some of its best generals to death in the middle of a war, and then belatedly deciding that probably wasn't the greatest idea. It led to all kinds of messes, mostly military messes. They'd invade somewhere and then change their minds. It did not work very well. Now, there are great shortcomings in the system of representative democracy that we see in many places. We'll get to some of those in a minute. But I just wanted to, rather than arguing one way or the other, just make the point that this is a radical departure. It's still democratic, but it is a radical departure from us normal ways of doing things. And if this gets adopted worldwide or in any significant amount, you could see it leading to more instability and actually just making the current problems worse. But regardless, it is a rejection of the current way of doing things. Now, it's also becoming an increasingly popular idea of combining this with the internet. And this is sometimes known as democracy 2.0. And it's about using modern technology so that rather than people just voting once every 4 years for their representatives, they can instead much more easily now be consulted online about every decision. If you look back to, say, the Founding Fathers and to the 19th century, it simply wasn't feasible to have every voter vote on every decision. If every vote in Congress was instead opened up to the entire population of the United States, it would take months to make any decision. But now, with technology, it is conceivable to have some kind of secure system where, at least in theory, where people could vote quite easily on everything that's put before Congress. And so people are asking, well, what's the point of Congress or Parliament then? Why don't we just have this direct democracy? And one of the best, the most recent examples of this is the Pirate Party. We get to the pirates from our title. Sorry to disappoint you if you're expecting people with eye patches and parrots and talked with an accent like they were from Somerset, which incidentally, completely irrelevantly, pirates sound like they're from Somerset in the UK, because in Treasure Island, Long John Silver is from Somerset. He was played in one of the first pirate movies by someone who gave him a strong Somerset accent, and now all pirates sound like they are from Somerset and say things like "arr" a lot. Not sure how we got to there from direct democracy. But anyway, the Pirate Party, it's just about the strangest and geekiest party that you can imagine. The movement really took off in 2006. There are different pirate parties in different countries. And if you remember back to the early days of the internet, copying music and videos, putting them online, that was quite a big deal. And then the copyright holders, they tried to get the governments to crack down on copyright piracy. And so pirate parties grew out of a movement opposing this, either because, you know, ideologically they wanted information to be free, or because they opposed the government on the internet. They're also very much against surveillance and government use of the internet to spy on people. So they tend to be pro-WikiLeaks. Some of their supporters can be libertarian or even anarchist. But these are kind of the common themes. You know, right to privacy, transparency, freedom of information. But it has morphed into what could be called a democracy 2.0 movement that believes that technology should radically change the way we do government, and that we should use it to give ordinary people a voice. And so they often set policy, and it's different for different pirate parties, but in general they often set policy positions, choose leaders, this kind of thing, through online voting and mass participation. The Icelandic Pirate Party, which is the one that has been significantly in the news last month, they were founded about 4 years ago. And last month they won, I think it was October 28th, 29th, the election, 15% of the vote. That makes them the third largest party in Ireland. In 4 years, they've gone to become the third largest party in Ireland. That's a huge growth, huge development. And the polls, at some points, they pointed to this brand new party actually taking over the Icelandic government. becoming the number one party in Iceland, which would have led to some fantastic headlines. Iceland taken over by pirates. I wanted it to happen just so I could write that headline. Didn't quite happen, but you've still got a strong pirate base in Iceland. And this, but they're not, the Pirate Party are not the only party in this rejection of mainstream liberal democracy and this push for direct democracy as an alternative. Beppe Grillo in Italy, he launched the Five Star Movement. And they similarly, they've come from absolutely nowhere to become a major political force. Beppe Grillo, who used to be a comedian, now he leads a party. They came second in the 2013 general election. And when you consider that all the other blocs that they are against are actually coalitions of multiple parties, they are the biggest single party in Italy. This movement that came from nowhere. And they too, they're all about direct democracy. Its members, they voted for its parliamentary candidates in both the Italian Parliament and the European Parliament in online polls. They decided key decisions of strategy, like who they're going to ally with in the European Parliament, again through online votes. They decided their policies on whether they're going to support or reject this specific policy through online votes. And this campaign, it's set up as a campaign against the establishment. A lot of the members of the Five Star Movement that they were voted in, they're just in their early 20s. The vast majority have no previous political experience. They were chosen, the candidates were chosen through votes on Beppe Grillo's blog. The Five Star Movement, it refuses to take public money. The candidates, they promise to only take part of their salaries, to not hold office for more than 2 terms. And Beppe Grillo, he said that those 2013 elections were a rejection of politics as it has been presented in recent years. It was a rejection of inefficient institutions of politics that have appeared morally non-credible. So you'll notice he's not rejecting just political parties, but as he said, it's about institutions of politics that the Italian people, that his party, is rejecting. The very way of doing things, the fabric of Italian politics. So Italy decided, I mean, this was, when you think about what Italian voters did here, they could have elected the usual politicians, or they could have voted for some completely unknown faces. Some people, again, only in their 20s, people that had no political experience, there was no political track record, they could look at to see what these people were like, and they voted for the unknown. That shows how fed up they were, they still are, with politics as usual, with the current way of doing things. Now, when new movements, new parties have been successful in the past, typically they're made up of defectors from other parties. But instead, this is somewhere that's come from scratch, all new candidates, that's just exploded. It's the same with the Pirate Party in Iceland and other parties across Europe. It would be like, could you imagine a brand new party just formed a few years ago winning 25% or 15% of the vote in US elections? It's a huge shift and represents a major rejection of politics as normal. The way Italians see it, just the whole, not just people in power, but the whole system is corrupt, and therefore the only solution is to vote for a new system. So why did these parties become popular? Well, it often is a response to corruption. And they feel like whoever they vote for, things are going to be corrupt. Here's the deputy leader of Iceland's, or a deputy leader from Iceland's Pirate Party, describing their commitment to direct democracy and why they have it.
We want to create a platform where your voice can be heard, where you can come in and affect policymaking from the very start, and where we can have a democratic vote over these issues. So whether you're left, right, middle, wherever, it doesn't matter. Everyone belongs there because it's about redistributing power. It's like a breath of fresh air in a way, and I think that's what people are hoping for, because they're tired of the corruption, but people haven't had any alternatives, and now they have an alternative to that. They want to do something different, because it just seems that they'll stop at nothing. Like, they're so openly corrupt. They're not even trying to hide it. And it shows that this is actually, and my feeling is that these individuals actually feel like this is okay. Like, this is just the way of the world. This is how it is. We're the kings on the hill, and this is how we do it. And I think that's what infuriates people.
A breath of fresh air. People are tired of corruption. Redistribution of power. You know, that's what it's all about. And you can certainly see why people feel that way and why they vote for these groups. It's not hard at all to sympathize with the voters for Iceland's Pirate Party and other similar groups when you do see all of that corruption. You may remember the Panama Papers earlier in the year, and Mr. Flurry had a program on them, and Iceland was one of the places hit hardest by the Panama Papers. It exposed corruption right at the top of the Icelandic government. It led to the downfall of that government. So no wonder people in Iceland are saying, well, politics as usual isn't working, because it isn't. You know, they say normal voting for political parties isn't working. No matter who you vote for, it's just the same. We need something radically different. So as I said, this isn't an attack on direct democracy. Instead, it's showing that people are just fed up and angry with the common way of doing politics. And this goes even beyond new political parties. You see, this kind of direct democracy is being adopted by mainstream parties. You see more countries now having referenda. In Britain, we had our vote on membership of the EU, and there is precedent for that. We had a vote on that back in the 70s. But typically, referenda haven't normally been the part of the way we do things, but we've had a few recently. We had that. We had the referendum on the alternative vote. Scotland had their independence referendum. Britain is normally a representative democracy, but you're seeing, and again, these are kind of big questions, so in some ways they are exceptional circumstances, but you are seeing now this shift to direct democracy, where there was no direct democracy before the mid-1970s. The Netherlands, they've gone even further in this direction. In 2015, they passed a law that says if 300,000 people sign a petition on a law, it will trigger a referendum on that law. The referendum is non-binding, but that's a significant step now to direct democracy. No longer is the business of democracy left to politicians. In the Netherlands, people can demand a say if they feel strongly, and if enough people feel strongly about a specific law. But let's move on now and look at another way that liberal democracy is being rejected. And this is really the opposite of direct democracy, and that is technocratic rule. And this also sees major problems with liberal democracy. It basically sees liberal democracy failing, and it sees liberal democracy with problems that it fails to solve. And it says the opposite of direct democracy. Let's give less power to the people. Let's get some experts, some technocrats in there, some really smart people. Let's put them in charge, and they can fix it. Rather than having just this pendulum swing of democracy and different people coming in and out of power. And we had a very recent example of direct democracy in Iceland with the pirates. We see it with technocracy or technocratic rule as well. Another recent example, again from October. It's time for the peasants. Lithuania, they held elections. It was in a couple of rounds on the 9th and the 23rd of October. And the largest party was a group called the Peasants and Green Union. And as I said, the peasants from the title, they won 54 seats. But what was really remarkable, what really shocked a lot of people, is in the election 4 years ago, they had only one seat. They went from one seat to being the biggest party in Parliament. Here's a quick clip from Euronews summarising just those stunning election results.
There's been a surprise result in Lithuania's general election, with political newcomers, the Peasant and Green Union, claiming victory. The agrarian bloc is set to win between 54 and 56 seats out of the 141-member parliament. It's the biggest victory by a single party in 20 years. Its success comes after a campaign run by party leader Saulius Skvernelis. It was dominated by issues such as low wages and how to stem the flow of Lithuanian workers to other parts of the EU. A coalition is now on the cards, but the party's chairman, billionaire industrial farmer Ramanas Karbauskis, has raised the possibility of creating a technocratic government. The party which had been favourite to win was Lithuania's Conservative Homeland Union Party, but they've only secured second place with 31 seats. Their leader said the results showed a desire for change in the country. The incumbent ruling party, the Social Democrats, have trailed in third with around 17 seats, with the remaining seats split among several smaller parties.
So it's not just America where the polls getting things wrong. And you get a sense there with the instability that we're seeing here. Major instability. The party that was ruling is now in third. A party just went from having one member of parliament to having the biggest victory in 20 years of any single political party. That's a revolution. And again, a new party, people desperate for not just a new politicians, but a new way of doing things. And as you heard alluded to there, one of the core parts of their platform was technocratic rule. And their policy was to essentially say, look, we're just going to put a bunch of experts in charge, and then we'll just get out of the way and we'll let them do their thing. Now, in this case, that technocratic rule is democratic. It seems like the people have chosen that. They voted for it. But there are many calling now for undemocratic technocratic rule. And some of this came after Brexit and after Donald Trump's election. Here's Matthew Paris. He's a conservative, and he wrote in The Spectator, "The election of Donald Trump as president of the United States may have signaled the death of the closest thing we have to a religion in politics. On both sides of the Atlantic, democracy risks being knocked from the high altar as an unmitigated and unquestionable good." And he goes through all these different votes that there's been around Europe, and he writes, "The reason I'm beginning to question democracy is that it is producing results I profoundly dislike." Now, he's far from the only one that's saying this, and Jason Brenner, he's a political philosopher at Georgetown University, and he's just written a book that has seen a lot of press coverage. I've seen it mentioned a few times in the papers, and I've seen quite a few different articles from him writing about it, called Against Democracy. And in that book, he calls for a epistocracy. Epistocracy, and by that he means it means the rule of the knowledgeable, and it would essentially be a system that gives votes to and gives a voice to university graduates and people that are generally been given a lot of knowledge and education in this world's education system, and take it away from people without university education. And it would just be he discusses a few different ways of doing this, but basically it would concentrate power with those with the most knowledge. And he had an article in Foreign Policy after Donald Trump's election. He wrote this book before that. And he wrote, "Trump's victory is the victory of the uninformed. But to be fair, Clinton's victory would also have been. Democracy is the rule of the people, but the people are in many ways unfit to rule." Now, to be fair to him, his case is much more well-reasoned than just, "I don't like Donald Trump and Brexit, therefore the people are stupid and unfit to rule." He does point to some genuine flaws in democracy. As Winston Churchill famously said, democracy is the worst form of government, apart from all those others we've tried. But he still is a backlash against democracy. And in a lot of ways, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, Mr. Obama, they're part of the same movement, or at least they share a lot of its basic ideas. The left has given more and more power to unelected bureaucrats, and these type of bureaucrats, they've amassed massive power under Mr. Obama. And it's not just in America. Across the world, we see unelected judges now becoming much more politically active, playing a much greater role in striking down laws. And again, this has largely been a movement from the left. Trumpet managing editor Joel Hilliker, he wrote about this a few years ago in an article called "Beware the Well-Educated Technocrats." And here he was discussing a speech given by Oklahoma Senator James Lankford. And he writes, Lankford quoted Cass Sunstein, who headed the Office of Information Regulatory Affairs, a powerful office that oversees government regulation for most of Mr. Obama's first term. According to Lankford, Sunstein said that America will be better off if run by a well-educated group of technocrats, rather than through a democratic process. Mr. Hilliker writes, "In other words, so many of the issues facing the country are too complicated for common people to decide. We need a handful of super smart people to make all the decisions for us." And he talked about how the technocrats are convinced that they can run everything better than the way they're being done. Any kind of complex industry, says no problem is beyond their capacity to solve. They're issuing edicts, handing round down regulations, taking on new projects, gobbling up the private sector at an unprecedented rate. And so he wrote about how this trust in technocrats, it leads to people giving the government more and more power over their lives, because for these technocrats to fix things, to fix industry, healthcare, roads, banking, you name it, to fix it, they need to control it first. And the EU loves this. And this is where these two movements, direct democracy and technocratic rule, feed off each other. Because you get this cycle where the elite don't want to listen to the people, so they appoint technocrats. The people feel like they're not being listened to, because they're not. And so then they vote for more direct democracy. And so remember that Dutch referendum law that I mentioned, where people could now trigger a referendum. It was triggered over the EU-Ukraine treaty. The Dutch in April, they voted no to this treaty, but it looks like this treaty is going to go ahead anyway. The government is ignoring this referendum. This is routine in the EU. The EU Observer, they noted in November 4th that if the Dutch government were to veto the EU-Ukraine treaty, it would be the first time since the Swedish no vote against joining the Euro in 2013 that an EU referendum which went the wrong way for Brussels was respected. And then it goes through a few examples where referendums are just routinely ignored in the European Union because they believe in technocratic rule for the most part. At least those within the EU do, like the EU officials. So we can likely add the Dutch EU-Ukraine treaty referendum to the list of ignored referendums at a moment when respecting the will of the voter is easier and more palatable than ever. But refusals to drop relatively empty pledges about increasing Ukraine participation to EU-led civilian and military crisis management operations may come back to haunt the EU when the treaty becomes another symbol of how unwilling or incapable it is at addressing the citizens' concerns. And we saw the same kind of thing in Italy. Remember, we were talking about the five-star movement, Beppe Grillo, in Italy. What was there before they really rose to the power? A technocratic government put in place by the European Union. The European Union didn't like what Silvio Berlusconi was doing. It's hard to fault them on that. Silvio Berlusconi was, in general, quite a hard person to like what he was doing in a whole number of different ways. But then the European Union, this undemocratic body, and Germany stepped in there. I mean, Germany's not an undemocratic body, but they weren't voted for by Italians. They stepped in there, they took control, they put in a different... They essentially pulled the rug out of Berlusconi. They put in their own technocratic government. And the response, you get Beppe Grillo and the Five Star Movement. These two movements feed into each other. They're a vicious cycle. They build on each other, they make it, and they bring out more and more extremes in each other. The elites just ignore the people, the elites become more corrupt, the people then have a much greater desire for a whole new way of doing things, a whole new system. The anger grows, the divide grows. Now, at the start, I did promise you some Donald Trump. Well, where does he fit in? Well, a final trend that we're seeing is, I'll call it, illiberal democracy. Now, this was a term coined by Hungarian President Viktor Orban, and essentially these are still democracies, but they go against the norms of liberal democracy. And I'll use the term a liberal democracy because Viktor Orban did, not necessarily because I think it's the greatest description of them, but this is a trend. It includes Hungarian President Viktor Orban, it includes Poland's Law and Justice Party that came to power earlier in the year, it includes the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, it includes France's National Front, and it includes Donald Trump in America. And in many ways, this is the hardest one to talk about because it covers a lot that is really distorted by the media. As I mentioned earlier, the left, they've gotten control of many of the levers of power in liberal democracy. They've got a lot of that now has been taken over by these technocrats. You know, they've moved in. The left generally controls judiciaries. They've been using them to push for left-wing ideas. For example, with the homosexual marriage movement, you have now seen a few countries vote for that. But at first, a lot of the first countries to go that way were the ways where that was imposed by against popular opinion by a left-wing judiciary. It's something we've seen in America, but we've seen that around the world. The left, they can generally control central banks and the financial institutions, and so they use them to influence economic policy and bring those to the left. And so then when people on the right want to bring things in their preferred direction, well, because of this kind of capture by the left of the different bureaucracies and judiciary, they can't do that without trying to take then political control of the judiciary, political control of some of these bureaucracies. And when then they do those kind of things, left-wing journalists scream blue murder. So we see this in Eastern Europe. We're seeing this now with Donald Trump, and Mr. Stephen Fleury yesterday spoke about something similar, where you see someone on the right does something that the left doesn't like and it's all over the papers. Someone on the left does essentially the same thing, but in the preferred direction of many journalists, and the newspapers are silent. And so we've seen one of the norms of liberal democracy is that the political process doesn't really interfere in the judiciary. And this is something we've seen in Poland. The left has really captured the judiciary. The right comes along and tries to rectify that. And then there's this great outcry about how Poland's now an illiberal democracy, how it's violating democratic norms, how it's unconstitutional. I'm not an expert on Polish constitutional law, so I'm not going to weigh in on that. But that's the exact situation you see. But that kind of thing is dangerous because it makes it very hard to see where leaders are simply pushing back against the left-wing control and where they're shifting maybe towards genuine illiberalism or oppression. And when it comes to someone like Viktor Orban, I genuinely don't really know, and I don't really know a way of telling whether he is merely pushing back against left-wing control or whether he has kind of stepped over the line now into a more dangerous authoritarian nationalistic or extreme nationalistic or perhaps even a racist type of regime. And the left try to characterize him as that, and it makes it very hard to tell if he's actually gone in that direction, because he is partnered with some very worrying people like Jobbik, that has some very anti-Semitic and anti-Gypsy and pro-Nazi type of connotations. So in some ways, by shifting the whole system to the left is forcing those on the right to smash the system. And so if you force people like the Front National, like Alternative for Deutschland, like the Donald Trump movement to smash the system, well, then they may well become more extreme than they would have been otherwise. So this trend to illiberal democracy, as I said, in a lot of ways, it's probably the more moderate of the three that we've talked about, with direct democracy and technocratic rule. But it is still a trend now that is saying the way we're doing politics doesn't work. You know, Donald Trump talks about draining the swamp, and you can see why. We've talked about the massive corruption that there is in a lot of these central governments. But it remains, you know, it remains a movement now that is calling for the end of the general way of doing things, the way of conducting politics that has been the norm over the last few decades. And you can really see all these trends building off each other. You know, the elites don't like the ones they consider the illiberals, so they take power from the people. Then the illiberals have to become more extreme to get back power, and then those in the direct democracy camp grow. But what I just really want to focus on is that all three of these trends, they have the same cause, a rejection of the current political system, and you see it everywhere. As there's a huge trend in Europe. We've been talking about this for 5 years or more, and so it is easy to become desensitized. It seems like almost every month we have a different, brand new party that has shot to prominence in some country in Europe. It's hitting more and more countries, you know, but it is a huge story. And this trend has hit Greece, it's hit Lithuania, it's hit Iceland, Portugal, Spain, France, Finland, the Netherlands, Sweden. And you'll note, and it's hit those countries. It has also hit Germany, but not yet to the same extent. Not to the extent that you're seeing brand new parties with double-digit polls and with the possibility of taking over the government, or actually having taken over the government, but it's growing there as well. So there's a whole load of dissatisfaction with the current political system in a whole load of places. And it's a trend that once it gets started really builds on itself. These new parties, they take votes from the existing ones. Then these existing ones no longer have enough votes to become coalitions, to form coalitions. They stop working. These new parties, they reject politics as normal, so they can't form coalitions easily with the traditional parties that they've just been denouncing throughout the whole campaign. So then you get gridlock, you get Spain taking months and months and months to form a government. You can't get governments together, and then people just become even more fed up with politics as normal. They vote even more for new parties, and then in Greece, you see where the country has gone through a series of different upstart parties that didn't have any significant political role until after the financial crisis, and they've just been going through more and more extreme parties as they go and as each one fails. Because Greece is essentially controlled by the technocratic government of the European Union. So none of these parties, no matter how radical, can change it or have been able to change it. Each time each party fails to challenge the technocrats, they vote for a more extreme, more illiberal, usually on this case far left, party. So the current political system is failing. And you rarely get tweaks to political systems. You get revolutions. And that is where this kind of smash the system movement is leading. It's going to play out in very different ways in different countries. But that is where this is leading. We'll take a quick break and we'll talk about now, when we come back, another closely related trend stemming from the same causes and contributing and building alongside this one. So stick around for that.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week, condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com, sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, guest hosting for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. If you have any comments, questions about today's show or any other show, you can email us at letters@kpcg.fm. We've been talking about the rejection of mainstream liberal democracy during the first half. Now I want to talk about another growing trend that we're seeing in the world, that we also saw in the 1930s, that we also see sweeping across Europe, that we also see in Donald Trump's election. And as we get into this one, I first want to give a bit of background. One of the texts that we come back to again and again in the international relations class at Herbert W. Armstrong College is an essay called The Love of One's Own and Importance of Place by George Friedman. Outside of some articles by Mr. Armstrong, it's one of the first handouts that we give out for reading because it is a great foundation to understanding world events. And it's rooted in something that Mr. Armstrong spoke about a lot, something he called the empirical self. And I'll let him explain this in his own words.
I've explained how mother love is even selfish. She doesn't love other children the same way that she does her own. And many a mother doesn't love other children at all. But her own is part of her, came out of her. That's selfish. And self is an empirical self. It includes everything that is yours. Now, that can even be your football team, your basketball team, your baseball team. You root for them. You want them to win. You don't like the other team. You see, you're selfish. And you take sides. And that gets into competition. And that gets into strife. And it gets into the very opposite of the cooperation and love that existed between God and the Word.
International relations class here is really rooted in a biblical understanding of human nature, and it's something that I knew, but even as teaching this class, I've just been surprised how often we have come back to human nature and a biblical understanding of human nature when it comes to understanding world events. It comes up just about every class. And there you heard from Mr. Armstrong talking about the empirical self. People love what is theirs, what belongs to them, their family, their sports team, as you heard, their political party, their nation. And that's a theme that comes up a lot. They don't necessarily call it empirical self, but it comes a lot with a lot of secular writers as well. For example, as I think I've mentioned before on this program, Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations is really rooted in this concept of people generally being selfish and people loving their family, their nation, their religion, these various things that are an extension of themselves. And this idea is at the heart of that article, The Love of One's Own and Importance of Place by George Friedman. And it's at the heart of nationalism, loyalty to and love of one's own nation. Now, one of the many things that Friedman explains in this essay is why nationalism tends to be stronger among the poor and weaker among the elite. So he talks about how that the elite tend to be much less tied to their own country. In general, they have much more in common with the elites of other countries than they do with their own countrymen. But then also, just from a very practical note, he writes, it is easier for the wealthy to shield themselves from a fate shared with their community than it is for middle and lower class citizens. So the wealthy, they can store money in other countries. If their country goes into bad times, it's easier for them to move abroad taken to the most extreme. If their country is invaded, it's much easier for them to get out. Whereas, as Friedman writes, no such option exists for those who are not wealthy. Their fate is more intimately bound up with their nation's fate. And so then he writes, it follows logically from this that the lower classes would tend to be much more conservative in the risks they want their country to take on a spectrum of international relations. So he says that they're more risk-averse, more mistrustful of the intentions of foreign countries, more suspicious of the more extravagant claims made by the rich intellectuals about the benefits of transcending nationalism. And so he talks about how it's logical for the poor to be more nationalistic. And Hans J. Morgenthau, he makes exactly the same point in our main textbook for international relations, other than the Bible and some of those articles by Mr. Armstrong, called and his book Politics Among Nations. And he notes the same connection between security and nationalism. The less secure people are, the more they need their nation, the more nationalistic they're likely to be. Now, just with liberal democracy, I need to define my terms here, and because nationalism is another one of those words that can be used to mean a whole range of things. So I'm using it the same way Morgenthau does, that is, an identification of your nature, you know, seeing your nation as part of your empirical self. Now, nationalism, it can be good or bad. Mr. Armstrong wrote about this in a 1962 Plain Truth Personal on patriotism. He writes, is it wrong to love your own country? Of course not. Didn't Jesus teach that we should love even our enemies? Love isn't wrong. But then in this same personal, he writes, but you see that this natural human nature love looks on those outside its extended self, its empirical self, as its enemy. When we are thinking and speaking of national considerations, human nature is patriotic towards one's own country because then it becomes part of his extended self. And so there is a feeling of antagonism towards another country when brought into comparison with his own. Actually, it is a form of hate. This world's civilization is founded on that carnal attitude. It is the natural attitude of competition. So the first type of love of one's own country that Mr. Armstrong spoke about is not wrong, and in that sense patriotism or nationalism is not wrong. But then with human nature, that turns so quickly into hate for the other. Now, a certain amount of nationalism is essential for democracy. People must feel like they belong to that political body. They need to feel that people in that same nation who voted a different way in an election are still part of the same greater self. And we've talked about this when we've talked about why the euro doesn't work. And there are dangers then in not enough of that type of nationalism. If the leaders become so kind of internationalized that they don't love their country anymore, that is something that can be very dangerous. But then when nationalism gets stronger, there are dangers there too. We saw that in the run-up to World War II in Europe. And nationalism in Europe has repeatedly proven incredibly dangerous. And nationalism, Morgenthau notes, is especially dangerous when it blames the problems of the people on a foreign enemy that can be fought and defeated in battle. And then it gets the masses of the people behind the war aims of the government, and it can lead to some very vicious wars. Now, personally, I don't think Donald Trump is really part of that kind of dangerous nationalism. Personally, I'm certainly not a Trump fan, and as we talked about on this program, he's not going to solve America's problems. But, you know, in general, for America, and especially for those governing America, they need more love of their country, not less. And so in that sense, I don't think Donald Trump is going to an extreme there. But what I wanted to focus on is that Donald Trump is part of a global upswing in nationalism. He's part of a trend that we see in Russia, we see in China, we see in Europe. And it's that global trend of which Donald Trump is just a symptom that is dangerous, and even just a smaller symptom. And I don't really have time to summarize the whole of this chapter in Morgenthau, but towards the end, he writes, thus in the last quarter of the 20th century, and he's writing this, I think, in the 60s, I'm not sure exactly when this edition was updated. I can have a look, though. Well, he died in 1980. Looks like the latest copyright is 1978. But thus, in the last quarter of the 20th century, intensified individual frustrations and anxieties have called forth a more intensive identification on the part of the individual with the power and foreign policies of the nation. If, therefore, the present trend towards ever-increasing domestic frustrations and international instability is not reversed, and that's exactly what we see, ever-increasing domestic frustrations, economic problems, international instability. So he says, if that is not reversed in the United States is likely to partake to a growing extent of those tendencies in modern culture which have found their most extreme manifestations in Soviet Russia and National Socialist Germany. Tendencies that make for an ever more complete and intensive identification of the individual with the nation. And I think he's right. We do see that within the United States. And as I said, though, if anything, the United States kind of went to the other extreme in terms of the identification of the individual with the nation. But it's a trend that I think we see much more dangerously in Russia, in Europe. Just to continue this quote, he writes, "In this completeness and intensification of identification, we have one of the roots of the ferocity and ruthlessness of modern foreign policy, where national aspirations for power clash with each other, supported by virtually total populations with an unqualified dedication and intensity of feeling which in former periods of history only the issues of religion could command." And that's the danger of nationalism, that it can lead to those ferocious clashes. And we talked about the power of religion earlier, and I think we're going to see in Europe, well, Mr. Armstrong said it, talked about how in Europe we're going to see the revival of religion, and we talked on an earlier program about how really you see the global revival of religion. But you see this revival of nationalism as well. People are becoming less secure, therefore more dependent upon the nation, and then they end up being much more closely identified then with the nation and with its success. The other point that Morgenthau makes in this chapter is that he talks about how the less ability people have, one of the bases of his whole book is that people want to exercise power over other people, control over other people, and the poorer people are, the more insecure they are, the less they're doing economically, the fewer opportunities they have to do this individually, and so the more they want to do it on a national level and have their nation and have power over other people. I think that's some interesting analysis that I've not seen elsewhere. It's maybe not quite as convincing as some other things that Morgenthau writes, but it's still worth taking note of. So we see this in Europe. We see this probably more in Europe than in America, though Donald Trump is part of the same trend. So bringing then both halves of this program together, before and after the break, the financial crisis and the general instability, you know, that has led to a rejection of the current political system. And at the same time, global and financial instability, it's led to the increase of nationalism, something that can lead to more and more dangerous wars. And we saw both these trends in the 1930s again, or before. And that led to the most destructive war we have seen in the history of the world to date. The resulting picture is not good. People unhappy with the way governments have run. And you can see from this why the world is heading into more stability. And this ties into a whole load of Bible prophecies. Mr. Flurry's been talking about Great Again, our new booklet that talks about what's prophesied more for America domestically. And you can get that for free at thetrumpet.com. Or if you have any trouble ordering any of these, just email us at td@kpcg.fm. We want to give them to you for free. That's already been paid for. We've also said for years that a strong man will come to power in Europe. And you can see how this intensified nationalism, how this unstable world, this dissatisfaction with the current political system will lead to that. And here's a clip from a Key of David program last year where Mr. Gerald Flurry talks about exactly that.
The German people are known to get very anxious when they see a huge problem like that, and they will seek out a strong man for emergencies, and they now face an emergency. And Daniel 8 prophesies in verse 23 that there is going to be a strong man rise up in Europe and going to lead that European power to do a lot of damage in this world, more than anybody else in this end time. Now that is prophesied, and it's going to happen. And even this article talks about the people could very easily lose faith in the government and want a stronger government or a strong man. And this is all causing Germany and the Europeans to build up their nuclear power.
So you see that everywhere, people losing faith in their government. You see nationalism and instability in Europe, people wanting a strong leader, and all of this in a world with nuclear weapons. That is a dark picture. But as Mr. Flyer went on to conclude that Key of David program with, the Bible has a whole load of prophecies about a dark time before Christ returns to bring the best times that mankind has ever seen. And those good times will just keep on growing, keep on improving, keep on getting even brighter. So you take a sober look at politics in this world with a historic context, it is a dark picture. But it aligns exactly with what is prophesied, and those prophecies say that a much brighter picture is coming just beyond that darkness. So to learn more about this, to learn more about those trends, about the strong leader in Europe, the instability that will lead to that, you can write for our free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. That's another one we'd be happy to send to you from thetrumpet.com. You can order that, and you can look up other ways to order and contact us there. That's about it from me from this program. Don't forget to tune in tomorrow now for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here at KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial, and at kpcg.fm.